Good morning, everyone, and welcome back. Ms. Walker, would you please be willing to get me my other book for today? Could you please get me my other book for today? Okay, we're prepared to proceed. We have, once again, I'll just note on the record that we have Senior Judge Crawford here with us today, sitting as the fifth judge. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Crawford, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Elizabeth Harvey, and along with Bethany Payton O'Brien and Major Spencer Nelson, we represent the appellant, First Lieutenant Liam C. Latin, in this case. Your Honor, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. The special agent in this case violated the Fourth Amendment both fundamentally by conducting a general search under a warrant without any particularity as to the items to be seized, and also in a more specific manner by violating the actual language of that warrant and its expiration date. Special agent's conduct was problematic in four ways. First, the affidavit itself lacked the indicia of probable cause required to support a search of the phone. Secondly, because the warrant itself failed to list with particularity the items to be seized on the phone. Third, because she actually did conduct a general search of Lieutenant Latin's phone. And then fourth, when she ignored the expiration date clearly stated in the authorization and continued to search beyond the 16th of February 2019. Yet the military judge failed to recognize these violations and denied the defense's motion to suppress. This was an abuse of his discretion. While the Air Force Court below did recognize the constitutional breach, it erred when it misapplied the exclusionary rule.
Counsel, are you arguing that the affidavit does not establish probable cause?
Yes, Your Honor.
So under Herring, how do we distinguish between gross negligence and mere negligence? And how would that apply here?
Yes, Your Honor. Herring is a good case because it talks about the objective test, and it's what a reasonably well-trained officer would understand to be unconstitutional. A reasonably well-trained officer in the position of the special agent in this case would understand that a general search was not warranted and was not allowed. They would understand that the language of the warrant was, of the authorization, lacked the specificity required. They would understand, based on the Air Force's case of United States versus, upon this court's case of United States versus Richards, of the Supreme Court case of Riley v. California, the implications or the considerations to be given when seeking to search digital evidence. And I believe, Your Honor, that another applicable case beyond Herring is Groh versus Ramirez. In that case, it was a qualified immunity case, but the court found that despite an affidavit that was particular and a search that was actually constrained by the limits of probable cause, that just the facial invalidity of the warrant itself was more than mere negligence and actually lost the officer in that case qualified immunity. The military judge and the Air Force majority both treated the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule as a separate inquiry from its deterrent effect. But the Supreme Court has repeatedly linked the two. They've linked the objective reasonableness and good faith of law enforcement to the efficacy of exclusion in deterring future Fourth Amendment violations. They've done it in Evans, Davis, Leon, Kroll, and Herring. The Supreme Court in Davis v. United States established three categories of law enforcement conduct as it relates to the exclusionary rule. First, police conduct that's done in deliberate, reckless, or grossly negligent disregard for Fourth Amendment rights. Second, is police acting with an objectively reasonable good faith belief that their conduct is lawful? And this goes back to the Davis, Evans, Kroll, and Leon cases where there was a clerical error by court personnel or the legal basis for a search was later found to be unconstitutional. Those matters where, as the justice said in United States v. Davis, the only thing that would be served by excluding evidence there would be to deter good police work, conscientious police work. The third category was simple and isolated negligence, and that is the Herring case that Your Honor referred to, where it was a clerical error by the police department, but the evidence was that it was rare. It was very attenuated from the person actually conducting the search, and it was the officer who received the information had a good faith belief or was operating in good faith as to the information that he received. This case, the Air Force majority has already determined that that second category of objectively reasonable good faith doesn't fit. They've already considered Leon and the four categories or the four exceptions to the exception that Leon laid out and determined that there was no good faith in this case, that the special agent should not have been able to rely on a facially deficient warrant. So that already takes us out of the second category of cases established in Davis, which leaves us just with the Herring category, the simple isolated negligence category. Groh versus Ramirez tells us that this is not mere negligence either. It's not an absence of due care. This leaves only that first category, the deliberate, reckless, and grossly negligent disregard for Fourth Amendment rights. The agent's actions in this case were deliberate. She intended to conduct a general search of Lieutenant Lattin's phone. She said so numerous times in her testimony. She stated that anything that's on the phone on Joint Appendix on page 301, because the original authority gave us authority to search the entirety of the phone, that includes its contents at the time of seizure, anything that's on the phone belongs to the government from the time of seizure. She stated that she was paging through the phone looking for past potential victims on page 274. As I looked through the phone, I noticed that the initial victim in this case, her contact wasn't saved, so any number where the contact wasn't saved, I looked through too, just to see who it was or what they were talking about. And on page 271, I'm under the authority that everything that is on the phone from the moment I seize it now belongs to the government. The lower court's majority and the military judge treated the special agent's actions as an accident, a mistake, I believe is the term that the military judge used, because she thought that this was allowed. But that's not what the Herring v. United States rule tells us, which is that this has to be an objective test in that her actions, her beliefs, must be what a reasonably well-trained officer would believe. And that is not, in this case, that she would be allowed to take such a general search. In fact, she says, she also states that her belief that, well, you can't chop a phone in half, as though the only way to get into a phone or to look for evidence such as she was, or that she was seeking for, would be to dive into the entirety of the phone. However, on JA pages 74 through 113, you see prosecution 13, which is what the government did when they went to look at First Lieutenant Kay's phone. They took pictures of text messages as it displayed on the phone. The picture shows the front of the phone. And that was how they established all of the text messaging from Lieutenant Kay. They could have done the same thing. This phone, the special agent doesn't seem to have recognized that, but a reasonably well-trained officer would have.
Counselor, can I back you up a little bit?
Absolutely.
Let's go back to there's just so many moving parts to this case. If we go back to the first question, with just probable cause for the original search authorization, I wasn't expecting you to argue that there was no probable cause here. Can you explain why you think there was no probable cause for the original search authorization?
Mr. Turner, as far as the affidavit, the only mention of anything relating to any phone is that texted her boyfriend and that her boyfriend texted him. And there's a reproduction in the affidavit of a text message sent between and the boyfriend. And then it just says...
So we know that the victim went to a rape treatment center. The rape treatment center found appellant's DNA. And we know there were texts. And then we talked to the victim and the victim's boyfriend, and they show the investigators text messages. It seems like a search authorization that... Why is there not probable cause that there might be text messages on appellant's phone about that second incident?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess the the argument or the point that I'm trying to make is that the it mentioned that they're text messages, and then it says that at the in the conclusion, we talked to the lawyers and they said to get the phone for evidence. They don't explicitly say what they're looking for. They don't say we're seeking to corroborate this. There's no mention of any communication between, although apparently orally she did provide that information to the search authority. So to the extent that there's any indicia, you know, a scintilla of indicia of probable cause, it would be towards that text message conversation exclusively and certainly not towards any other part of the phone.
Okay. So a search authorization search, is the problem that it just wasn't specific enough or it wasn't explicit enough in tying, in stating what it was looking for or tying what it was looking for to the alleged crime?
Yes, sir. In stating all of the above, I guess. Yes, that in stating what they were looking for, in stating that you know the relevance to the crime and what else they might find, specifically what she was looking for.
Okay. And then moving on from the probable cause, let's go to the you believe the warrant that was the search authorization that was issued was facially invalid.
Yes, sir.
And why? Can you just explain quickly why was it facially invalid? Because it mentioned a crime, right, a violation of Article 120, and it said what it wanted to search. It wanted to seize and search appellant's phone. What more did it need to do to not be a facially invalid warrant?
It needed to specify the type of evidence it sought. It treated, the authorization treated the search as a search of Lieutenant Latin's person for DNA in a phone. However, there was a second search to be considered, which was the search of the phone. And so in that way, the authorization needed to specify, in the same way that it specified what they were looking for, they need to specify what they were looking for on the phone.
So it had to say text messages, or text messages in this date range, or pictures, or emails, or something more particular than just seize and search the phone.
Yes, sir. Turning, Your Honors, to the expiration date, the second granted issue.
Counsel, before you
yes.
go there, if the search authorization had said search the phone for text messages, would that have been sufficient?
If it had said search the phone for text messages between and the alleged victim in this case and her boyfriend, and particularly or by a date range, yes, Your Honor, that would have been specific. Just text messages, no, Your Honor, that would have been
specific. So date range would have been sufficient in your view?
Yes, Your Honor. We had a very, in this case, we had a very compact time frame. They met on the 25th of January, 2019. The alleged crime occurred on the 26th of January, 2019. The phone was seized by the 14th of February, 2019. It was very simple at that point to understand the dates involved. You know, the alleged victim had never met him before, that there was no nothing that could have occurred on the phone before that time.
Counsel, before you turn to the expiration date, can I ask a question about 311D5A, which says the prosecution has the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence either that the deterrence of future unlawful searches or seizures is not appreciable, or such deterrence does not outweigh the costs of the justice system of excluding the evidence. The military judge found both of those elements. And my question is about the second one, that the deterrence does not outweigh the cost of the justice system of excluding the evidence. It seems a little odd that the government proves this balancing test with evidence, but that's what the rule says, and the military judge found that it was proved. What deference does this court owe the military judge's determination on that specific point?
Well, Your Honor, certainly it's an abuse of discretion standard as to his ruling. A clearly erroneous standard as to his findings of fact. But as that's a conclusion of law that we believe that's a conclusion of law that the actual standard wasn't met, that the deterrence would not outweigh the costs. And in that case, then this court reviews that de novo. So. Also, the military judge's conclusion there stems from his finding all along that the warrant wasn't deficient, that there was good faith, that the plain view doctrine applied, that inevitable discovery applied. So all along the way, the military judge's previous conclusions that were shown to be wrong by the Air Force court's majority opinion led him to the conclusion that deterrence would not be effective here and that it would not outweigh the cost. So to that extent, Your Honor, this court should not give much deference, if any, to that conclusion, especially because his opinion or his ruling and the majority of the Air Force court seem to separate that balancing test out from this good faith inquiry, whereas all of the case law in the Supreme Court develops those things in conjunction with each other.
Does it matter that 311 doesn't seem to separate them?
No, Your Honor, and that's because this court has already found in United States versus Carter and then again in United States versus Hernandez that 311 should be read in conjunction with Leon and the cases that followed beyond that, even though some of the language doesn't match up exactly. And so in that way, Your Honor, I think that that's just another restatement of maybe that's the allowance for a Herring-type case, which isn't necessarily an objectively reasonable good faith exception, but is a simple and isolated negligence as recognized by Herring versus United States and therefore, you know, might factor into that deterrence balance.
In terms of the expiration date, since you wanted to get into that subject anyways, why shouldn't the language there be interpreted as meaning that the initiation of the search needed to occur within those 3 days rather than the culmination of the search within those 3 days?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Since I'm the one who asked the question, you're more than happy to have time to address it.
Certainly. Well, Your Honor, paragraph 3 talks about the initiation date, and paragraph 4 talks about expiration. I mean, there are two different functions served by two different paragraphs, and in fact, the boilerplate language that the search authority in this case, for whatever reason, chose not to apply is that these additional searches and follow-on searches can continue through the end of judicial proceedings, basically, you know, until this case isn't a case anymore. That was an option, and that also clearly, I think, illustrates what that paragraph was for, which is that it was when are these to end? When are these additional searches to end? And instead of using that option, he wrote in the 16th of February, 2019.
More questions?
Yeah. Related to that point, the investigator believed that she found evidence relevant to the second assault when she was just in the 3-day window when she was just scrolling through text messages. What difference does that make? The government argues that at that point, this is evidence of a crime. And whatever, even if it was a 3-day window, that all goes out the window. It's just like if you see someone's car and you search it and it becomes evidence in a crime, then you put it in the impound lot, you don't give it back to them. So why isn't that not what happened here with the phone? Even if the original search authorization expired after 3 days, once the government finds evidence relative to a crime that it's investigating, why doesn't that all go out the window?
Well, Your Honor, it's not just the basis of holding on to the phone and the evidence that she discovered during the 3-day window. It is the ongoing additional searches, the DCFL search, conducted several months after the expiration of this date. So it wasn't simply, certainly you find evidence in a car, the car is being held for as evidence of a crime, you impound it. But if an expiration date has occurred, the search authorization has expired, and now you want to go search the trunk some more, you need to go back and get another authorization. Same in this case.
And what if they had, she had just taken photographs? She's scrolling through appellant's text messages and she finds things she thinks are evidence. She takes photographs of them. Can they review those photographs at a later date? Or let's say they had the technology to copy all of his text messages onto a hard drive. Can they later, how does this expiration date work? Is it just the phone that they lose their access to after the 3 days? Or if they do that, then they can continue to review these things later as they prepare their, as they go on with their investigation? Or are they, after the 3 days, does the affidavit mean that they can't even look at that stuff anymore?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't mean that. It means that, because if you look at the language of that paragraph, it discusses additional searches, follow-on searches, additional analysis. It's basically a recognition that not all, especially in digital evidence cases, not all searches can be conducted at the scene of the initial search. That, you know, while you're standing there with a phone in hand, you aren't necessarily going to be able to do what you need to do, especially in cases that are more where the digital evidence is more relevant. And so that's what the paragraph is about. It's about follow-on searches, additional searches. So if there's evidence gathered within the time allowed for the, by the authorization, then certainly that's evidence of the crime. It's admitted into evidence, can be reviewed, and be used to prepare for trial. But it's when you go back to the original source to conduct additional searches, such as the DCFL, or to go back into further text messages and things that weren't discovered during that 3 days, that then becomes a warrantless search.
More questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Harvey. Major Peer.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Crawford, members of the court, and may it please.
You may want to pull the microphone just a little down a little more.
I'm Major J. Peer, and along with Colonel Naomi Dennis, we represent the United States. Appellant sexually assaulted, and while searching appellant's phone for text messages relevant to the sexual assault, the lead OSI agent stumbled upon text messages suggesting appellant was a witness to a completely separate sexual assault involving. Those text messages took on a different meaning months later, named appellant as her assailant. The military judge admitted the evidence from appellant's phone, and appellant was convicted of sexually assaulting both. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting the evidence from appellant's phone for two reasons. First, the exclusionary rule is a remedy that results in a windfall for the guilty and is a bitter pill that must be swallowed only as a last resort. It was not clearly erroneous for the military judge to deem the exclusionary rule was not appropriate in this case. Second, it was not clearly erroneous for the military judge to interpret the so-called expiration date in the search authorization in a common sense and reasonable way rather than a hyper-technical way that frustrated the very purpose of the search authorization. Now, I'll start with what is uncontested.
Can I focus on one thing that the OSI agent said on the stand in the course of addressing this point? In explaining her conduct, she said that she searched these text messages, quote, just to see who it was or what they were talking about. Isn't that an alarming statement for a law enforcement officer to be saying? It sounds voyeuristic rather than law enforcement oriented when she says, just to see who it was or what they were talking about.
It is troubling, Your Honor, and we acknowledge that in our brief. When you look at that statement in a vacuum, certainly it is troubling that an agent would say that she was paging through the phone and that she was just looking at the text messages to see what they were talking about. But that statement in a vacuum is not indicative of how she conducted her search and the reasonableness of her actions in actually conducting the search. And I think when you
when she conducted the search, though, as Ms. Harvey was talking about, she knew ahead of time that we were talking about a very narrow date range, that she didn't know the individuals involved, didn't know one another, and yet she was reaching back, the agent was reaching far back in times in terms of date range and looking at these earlier text messages. So why isn't that problematic?
Your Honor, I don't think it's problematic when this court considers the true nature of the relationship between appellant and appellant's boyfriend. The record shows, and the military judge relied on this in his ruling, that appellant and his boyfriend had a pre-existing relationship dating back to the time when they were at together. So it's certainly reasonable for the agent to conclude that there could be other messages on appellant's phone that predated that January 2019 time frame, specifically relating to the boyfriend and appellant. But certainly there was other evidence that...
Isn't that an extraordinarily tenuous relationship there? Why would there be material on the phone simply because there was some relationship between somebody else who was the girlfriend of that person.
Your Honor,
doesn't that go to the whole point of particularizing what you're looking for and not going on a fishing expedition?
Your Honor, she didn't go on a fishing expedition because when she was talking about paging through the phone, looking at the text messages to see what they were talking about, she was actually talking about looking for text messages related to the sexual assault. She wasn't paging through the phone looking for evidence that appellant used drugs or that he possessed child pornography. She limited her search specifically to evidence of the crime that she suspected appellant of
committing. But a crime, I'm trying to understand your point, a crime that she knew had happened within a very short period of time from when she was doing the search, and she's looking back at text messages that she knows, because of the chronological order, occurred months ago with people who were not connected to the crime.
Yes, Your Honor. So going back to my argument regarding the complaining witnesses or the victim's boyfriend and appellant and that pre-existing relationship, there was actually evidence of another pre-existing relationship. So appellant had texted with on the night of the sexual assault. And based on that information, the agent could have determined there was a fair probability that appellant had engaged in text messages with that individual that predated the incident due to that pre-existing relationship.
But involving a victim that appellant had never met before? Didn't know anything about?
Yes, Your Honor. Even though appellant and victim met on the night of the sexual assault, there were other witnesses to that incident, to the lead-up of the sexual assault, who could have provided relevant information to the investigation.
If we were to adopt that approach, wouldn't the whole Fourth Amendment be swallowed by the spiderweb connections out in the world in terms of who knows whom on Facebook or LinkedIn or anything else, and in terms of dates, the dates in terms of the date of the offense, that doesn't matter if you jump back months before and looking at text messages simply because, well, there could have been, might have been some connection somewhere. Where does the Fourth Amendment end up in your analysis?
Your Honor, this court and agents are limited by what they have probable cause to search appellant's phone for. And under these circumstances, the agent had a fair probability of believing that there was evidence relevant to the sexual assault on appellant's phone in the form of text messages, based on all the text messages that were available to her in conducting her investigation. And when we're looking and judging the agent's conduct, it's important to consider the other side of the balancing test, the costs of exclusion. And that's uncontested in this case, that the costs are high. But appellant does not address, neither in his briefs nor in his arguments here, just how high the costs are in this case. Here, exclusion would require the court to ignore probative and relevant evidence in the form of appellant's text messages, wherein he admitted to penetrating after knowing that she was blacked out. He bragged to his friends and his father that he penetrated her and then he passed her off to his friend. But that's not all. Exclusion here would require the court to preclude from ever testifying in perpetuity about what appellant did to her.
And let me ask a question. Would it be improper for this court to consider the following? The accused here, the appellant, would still be convicted of a serious crime, even if the information related to victim one, we were to say that evidence was not gained consistent with the Fourth Amendment. Is that something this court should consider in terms of the negative effect on society, where we would say, still convicted, it's still a righteous conviction for this other serious offense with this other victim? Or is that something we should not consider?
I think this court should consider sexual assault on its own. She's a completely separate victim. The cases were not related whatsoever. The two victims did not know each other. So for this court to simply preclude from ever testifying about what appellant did to her, simply because he was convicted of a wholly separate sexual assault, I don't think that would appropriately consider the cost of exclusion in this case. And in Ceccolini, which the military judge based his ruling on, the Supreme Court recognized that rules disqualifying knowledgeable witnesses from testifying are serious obstructions to the ascertainment of truth.
So how else do we, and when I say we, I mean that writ large, get law enforcement agents within the military to comply with the Fourth Amendment?
Your Honor,
because here we've got the situation, if we were to conclude, at this stage we're looking at it and saying there are problems here. The agent is saying, this is what I was taught at FLETC. So I think it's fair to say that in an instance like this, judge advocates would have been involved. There was testimony. The judge advocate was there. How do we get law enforcement to comply with the Fourth Amendment if we focus too heavily on the side of look at the negative effects of actually suppressing the evidence?
Your Honor, I think that's the difficulty with the exclusionary rule that the Supreme Court recognized in Herring and Davis. Now, certainly, applying the exclusionary rule in every case where there's some modicum of law enforcement misconduct would provide some deterrent effect. Certainly, the government does not argue with that notion. But in noting that the exclusionary rule is a bitter pill that must be swallowed only as a last resort, the Supreme Court is cautioning courts to be more judicious in applying the exclusionary rule simply to deter police conduct in marginal cases where the deterrence would be marginal.
Counsel, on that balancing test, it sounded like from the start of your argument that you thought we should apply a clearly erroneous standard in reviewing how the military judge balanced deterrence against the cost of law enforcement. But I understood appellant to say that it was really a legal conclusion that we reviewed de novo. Can you address that a little more?
Your Honor, I believe in coming to that conclusion, it requires the military judge to make numerous findings of fact, you know, how high exactly the costs are, what the deterrence benefits are, how culpable.
And that's a finding of fact, what the cost to the military justice system is. We can only disturb that if it's clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that is a finding of fact that is entitled to deference.
Thank you.
Also, back to the Chief Judge's question about how do we, as a court, deal with the agent's misguided view of her authority under the search authorization and what she could do with the phone once it was in the government's possession. I don't recall anywhere in the record where the government introduced any evidence to rebut the agent's testimony or to explain that that's not what she was taught at FLETC. They didn't bring in her supervisor or instructor from FLETC. I doubt that's what they're teaching there, unless it's changed since my day. But that still appears to be a misguided view of this agent that is on the record and stands unrebutted, unless I'm missing something in the record.
No, Your Honor, you're not missing anything. The government didn't provide anything specifically to rebut the agent's assertion of what she learned at FLETC. And I don't want to presume why they didn't do that, but certainly the military judge in his ruling determined that despite that testimony, which this court has noted is flawed, that the agent's conduct overall in conducting her investigation was reasonable despite that testimony. And the government acknowledges here that appellant's rights were violated when the search authorization was overbroad. And once the agent found out that was a second victim.
I just want to make sure we get that point. So the government is conceding that the search authorization was facially invalid.
Yes, Your Honor. And once the agent found out that Kate was a second victim in appellant's case, she should have sought an additional search authorization. But importantly, the military judge found that the agent didn't violate appellant's rights deliberately, recklessly, or with gross negligence. And he found that any wrong done to appellant's rights were done by accident, not design, and there was no evidence of recurring or systemic negligence. And these findings of fact are clearly supported by the record.
Now, in terms of systemic negligence, didn't the agent testify, I've been doing this for 2 years now. This is what they taught me at FLTSI. I've been doing this for 2 years. What's the problem? Isn't that systemic?
Your Honor, the record shows, so that testimony, although it was inarticulate, other instances of her conduct as a whole demonstrate that she conducted her search reasonably and that she is the type of agent who seeks out attorney advice and attempts to follow the law at every step of her investigation. So there was no recurring negligence, or the military judge did not certainly find that the agent was negligent in the case before him. So it was not unreasonable for him to find that there was no systemic or recurring negligence.
Doesn't that point that you just made, which is a correct one, that the evidence of record indicates that it was her practice to reach out and hear who was involved, and yet the government is conceding correctly, appropriately, I'm not trying to play gotcha on that point, that the search authorization was facially invalid. So doesn't a message need to be sent to the Air Force JAG Corps about the importance of JAG officers getting this right, being involved, being engaged, being knowledgeable, and about the importance of OSI agents knowing what they're doing when it comes to complying with the constitutional rights of our service members?
Your Honor, such a message would be important for this court to send. But this court can send that message in its opinion without applying the exclusionary rule.
Okay, fair enough. How would we do that? How would we phrase this opinion to accomplish the goal you just cited?
This court can issue an opinion stating that the attorneys who advised the agent at every step of the process and failed to advise her that the search authorization was facially overbroad and failed to advise her to get a second search authorization, that in and of itself was error. However, this court does not need to then take the next step of granting appellant a windfall and excluding all the evidence related to a second sexual assault.
Do you see the concern there, though? One would hope that message has already been sent to the JAGs and to the OSI agents, that they should comply with the training and the Constitution and so forth. If there isn't some type of penalty, what difference does that make? Won't we just be spinning into the wind?
Your Honor, the fact that there is no other penalty does not grant this court the authority to apply the exclusionary rule in a way in which the Supreme Court has cautioned courts not to do, to provide...
So are you saying that based on current Supreme Court precedent that we are prohibited, in this case based on these facts, we are prohibited from deciding that suppression is appropriate?
Yes, Your Honor.
What specifically prohibits us from doing that?
Your Honor, under the balancing test set forth in Herring and Davis, the government believes that the balance does not fall in the favor of exclusion in this case. And under MRE 311A3, the president has required courts to exclude evidence only when the deterrence benefits outweigh the costs, which they do not here.
So you're simply saying, based on the balancing test,
yes, Your Honor,
that it's not as if there is black letter law out there that says that in this type of scenario we would be prohibited from doing so. It's the government's position, if this court engages in a proper, from your viewpoint, balancing test, then it would not be appropriate for us to order the suppression of the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounded like you just said that you believe that the legal and investigative system in the military failed Special Agent at every step of this process. Is that, I'm paraphrasing, but is that essentially what you just said?
I wouldn't say failed, Your Honor, but failed to object.
I thought you had actually said failed a moment ago. But how is that not the definition of systematic negligence?
Your Honor, ultimately the exclusionary rule is intended to deter police conduct and not attorney conduct. So the agent here relied on, she's an agent who has demonstrated that she relies on the advice of counsel when she conducts searches. I mean, before she even sought to search appellant's phone, she contacted the legal office, presented them with the facts of the case, and it was the attorney who advised her to go and seek a search authorization. And then after she drafted her affidavit, she presented that to the attorney. The attorney gave her the thumbs up, and then she proceeded with the meeting with the search authority, again, accompanied by an attorney at that meeting. And again, no objections were raised at that point. And then, Your Honor,
I see your time has expired. Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Major Peer. Ms. Harvey?
Thank you, Your Honor. The government's argument seems to fall in the same trap that the Air Force Court majority does, which is to take a paternalistic view of this agent and her actions as if to suggest, well, it's not really her fault. She didn't mean it. She just didn't know any better. That is not the standard that the Supreme Court has set. This is an agent of the Air Force, OSI, acting in full authority as an agent of the United States, conducting a search of cell phone under the color of the authority granted by the search authority. We're not to sort of give her points for meaning well when she doesn't know the Fourth Amendment, she doesn't know the prevailing law. That is what the objective test in Herring versus United States tells us. As far as the balancing test, aside from the how it's laid out in Supreme Court cases, we do have the MRE 311 D5A aspect of it, which is that it is the government's burden to prove by preponderance of the evidence that deterrence would not outweigh the cost of exclusion, or that deterrence is not appreciable. As many of the judges here have already said, only an opinion in which this evidence is excluded gets forwarded to the headquarters of every military law enforcement agency, gets forwarded to and taught at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. An opinion that says, well, that wasn't right, but, well, you know, we allow the evidence to stay in, doesn't get that treatment, doesn't get that attention, and doesn't get the attention of the next special agent seeking to search somebody's cell phone. And that is what this balancing test is about, is the deterrence of future Fourth Amendment violations. So far, there's nothing about what the government has proposed that would do that. As far as balancing it against the social costs, the Supreme Court cases that refer to the cost refer to it in a general sense, a societal sense, a cost to society, a cost to the justice system of essentially putting an obstacle in front of the search for truth, potentially allowing somebody who is guilty of an offense to go free. That is the social cost. None of them look at the specifics of the offense itself. None of them, you know, not Davis or Evans or that progeny of cases, none of them look to whether or not in that particular case, exclusion of that particular evidence is too high a cost versus deterrence. It's always the general social cost. And in every single one of those cases, they have reinforced the idea from Leon that facially invalid warrants do not allow for good faith, and therefore an exception to the exclusionary rule is not to be found. And so by the government's concession that this was a facially invalid case, they've already put us into the category under Davis and in looking at Groh versus Ramirez of deliberate, reckless, and grossly negligent conduct, which exclusion of this evidence would have a great effect in deterring future Fourth Amendment violations of that type, of that nature. The final comment is just a quote from Justice Ginsburg's dissent in Herring v. United States, where she references a line from Terry v. Ohio. A ruling admitting evidence in a criminal trial has the necessary effect of legitimizing the conduct which produced the evidence, while an application of the exclusionary rule withholds the constitutional imprimatur. And that is what appellant asked for in this case.
Further questions from the bench? Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.